good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're listening to episode 711 of Unwelcome Guests, Facing the Failing Culture of Control, Part 4, The Sickening Development of Modern Medicine. I'm Robin Upton, and this week we're touching on a new topic for the show, the controversial subject of vaccines. And to set the scene, let's have a review of a couple of medical experiments carried out by the US Public Health Service, both of which resulted in a lot of deaths and suffering, and both of which were kept secret for decades. But before we do, let's hear Lynn Gehry. This is a repeat from the introduction way back in episode 472, introducing Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity.
This week, the reading focuses on his analysis of law, medicine, psychiatry, and the question of suffering and health generally. His critique of the medical system is scathing, and his analyses of the causes of ill health are drawn from his perspective as one involved with traditional Chinese medicine. They may be challenging to some listeners because in the course of his discussion, he rejects as fatuous what is a central belief of our society and a central justification for the program of domination and control, that we can live happily ever after. Yet he is not inviting his readers to a masochistic existence, though some could make that interpretation. Throughout the reading, he's alluded to later chapters in the book where new paradigms for human life and society will be introduced. That will begin in our readings next week, as we conclude with the first part of the book, designed to give us a thorough understanding of where we are and how we've gotten here. So let's continue with the conclusion of Chapter 5, The World Under Control, from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Life Under Contract. The tyranny of yes and no, the migration of life to a wholly domesticated realm, and the dwindling of the uncertain and undefined in favor of the expressly permitted and explicitly forbidden takes another form in laws, rules, and regulations. Here, the program of control manifests as a spreading legalism that infiltrates all aspects of modern life. In the ecological sphere, the shrinking of the wild is domestication, confinement, and the great indoors. In the personal sphere, it's the conquest of the child's spontaneity and creativity. In the social sphere, it is the codification of previously informal agreements, ethics, and mores. As legal scholar Paul Campos puts it, anyone who compares the legal domains of our society to those of the pre-modern state immediately becomes aware of a tremendous and ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space. Close quote. Our dependence on authority to delimit the realm of the permissible projects onto the collective level as the urge to regulate, to medicalize, juridify, and police every act of labor or play. Thanks to our schooling, we are accustomed to being told what is allowed, accustomed to authority determining right and wrong, and accustomed to coercive enforcement of these distinctions. Implicit in a world under control is that if something goes wrong, it must be someone's fault. Someone must bear legal responsibility. Someone must be punished, and I should be compensated. And so, children in authoritarian institutions such as schools resolve disputes by telling on each other, going to teacher, the source of authority. In religion, the same tendency manifests in the idea of God as a referee who will reward the just, punish the wicked, and make everything fair in the end. In law, this attitude motivates the burgeoning realm of the regulated, the ever-increasing contraction of formally unregulated social space, and our endemic reliance on lawsuits to resolve disputes. The rule of law has become a necessity as other forms of social coordination have broken down with the dissolution of community. In olden times, informal social pressures were far more potent than they are today, because people depended on their neighbors to meet economic and social needs. The goodwill of the community was extremely important, and the consequences of social shunning severe. Today in America, there are few real communities to speak of, only neighborhoods, and the opinion of neighbors matters little. As long as I obey all the laws, who cares what the neighbors think? I'm safe from anything they might do. I don't need to buy things from them. I don't need them to watch out for my children. I don't use the things they make. I don't depend on them for recreation.
Now, does that disconnected perspective, that obliviousness to how one impacts on the world, help us to understand the position taken by the US government with respect to the medical experiments that were carried out on Guatemalans in the 1940s? So on the one hand, they're going to use a legal technicality to say, well, we are not liable, we have sovereign immunity because this was carried out overseas. So they're going to deny any legal responsibility, but they're going to issue a well-worded apology and say how sorry they are. Now let's hear Robert Knight from an April 2012 episode of his show, 5 o'clock Shadow.
Recently, there was a documentary that was produced by Journeyman TV. Reporter David O'Shea went to Guatemala, he went to Tuskegee, and spoke with many of the still living victims of the U.S. medical experiments in Guatemala.
It was here, in Guatemala, hidden from public scrutiny, that the experiments took place. Conscripted soldiers, prisoners, prostitutes, the mentally ill, and even orphans like Marta Orellana, Guatemalans used by the U.S. government as human guinea pigs.
Pues sí, porque como digo yo, para experimentar, ¿verdad?
No one gave their consent, and they were certainly not informed that they were being infected with syphilis and gonorrhea.
¿Quién dijo que tenían que tener estas inyecciones? ¿Los americanos?
Sí, los americanos fueron los que me...
So then you have to ask, did they go back into the community? Did they spread this disease? Did we really give the people of Guatemala syphilis?
This is Tuskegee, Alabama, where the Guatemalan experiments were hatched. The site of America's most infamous medical experiment, which began in the 1930s and ran until the 70s, with the unambiguous title, Untreated Syphilis in the Male Negro. Here, doctors found African Americans already infected with syphilis and then left them untreated so that they could monitor their progress. They never told the men that they had the disease. It became a national disgrace.
I'm looking for the Pollard family gravesite because a number of the Pollard family people were in the Tuskegee study.
Historian Susan Reverby has spent over 20 years studying Tuskegee and knew some of the men.
So Mr. Pollard definitely died of syphilis and was in the study. And then the other people, you know, this is his wife, I don't know. We don't know what happened to the wives.
One of the doctors, John Cutler, still defended the Tuskegee study more than 20 years after it was exposed in the press and stopped, saying,
these individuals were contributing towards the health of the black community, rather than simply serving as guinea pigs for the study.
Even then, Cutler didn't want his guinea pigs to be finally treated for the syphilis they'd carried for decades.
It would be undesirable to go ahead and use large amounts of penicillin to treat the disease because it would interfere with the study.
It was while researching Cutler's role in Tuskegee that Susan Reverby made the remarkable discovery last year that he was head of another, much more invasive experiment started in 1946 in Guatemala.
I just completely... completely shocked. I had spent, you know, nearly 20 years explaining to everyone that no one had been given syphilis in Tuskegee, and here was a study with the title, Inoculation Syphilis, done by this man who had been involved in Tuskegee in the 60s, and then in the 90s is essentially justifying the study, and I was completely, I mean, nobody knew about this.
I see him as an evil man because of the undeniable circumstances that when he was told to discontinue the experiments in the U.S. because they were illegal and ethically wrong, decided to look for a place where he could literally get away with it.
Terry Collingsworth is a Washington-based human rights lawyer representing the Guatemalans who have emerged to file a class action lawsuit against the U.S. government.
The fact that they went to Guatemala is partly at least due to the fact that everyone understood that Guatemala was a place where there were no rights for poor people or people in prison, and that you could pretty much do what you wanted with them. So to take advantage of that kind of situation certainly multiplies the crime.
Collingsworth has a local lawyer handling the case in Guatemala. Some claim to be direct victims, and others, like Marta Cesaria's children, descendants of victims. One of them was born without a brain, and her severely disabled daughter was born with syphilis. Syphilis is a disease which, if not treated early enough, can lead to serious physical and mental illness, and can even kill. I'm about 3 hours from the Guatemalan capital, on the way to meet some former soldiers who were directly infected in the experiments. Now well into their 80s, they're some of the only known survivors. Federico Ramos Mesas was forcibly conscripted into the army in 1946 and soon became an unwitting participant in the study. He says he was subjected to a series of tests and treatments, but was never told what it was for. Not far from here is another affected family whose father was also forced into the army at the same time. They say syphilis killed him.
Lo inyectaban cada 15, cada mes. Pero nunca le dijeron a él para qué.
Their mother died with an open sore on her hip.
Que ella sí sufrió enorme ese dolor.
Le fue creciendo todo y todo, o sea que, y es una pierna, hasta se le, de una vez se le cayó cuando ella botó la piel, ¿verdad?
Victoria has been clinically blind since she was very young and believes it was the result of her father's illness.
Y yo le dije que yo no miraba bien.
Almost everything we know about the Guatemalan study is from these notes and letters in U.S. archives.
On Friday the 9th, we performed another experiment, inoculating 6 patients with pus and treating 3 of them.
Dr. Cutler's own correspondence, this one to his boss at the Public Health Service in New York, reveals he was well aware they were overstepping boundaries.
I hope that it would be possible to keep the work strictly in your hands, without necessity for outside advisors or workers other than those who fit into your program and who can be trusted not to talk. Sincerely, John C. Cutler.
Deeper into the Guatemalan countryside, I'm going to meet another former soldier infected by syphilitic prostitutes planted in the barracks by the doctors. He remembers being treated by American doctors at the military hospital.
Me vacunaron como 8 días.
Sadly, Gudiel will never know how the legal case ends. Not long after this interview, he died.
Ah, ya no voy a ir donde la chica.
Ya no más. Bueno, adiós.
Que le vaya bien.
Adiós, señor. Adiós.
I think every person who got infected, however the methodology was a victim of a serious crime, an invasive crime. Your body is your temple, so to speak, and to have someone without telling you expose you to a disease that would damage you is a really serious crime. But they did it with children, and to me that takes another level of wrong.
Behind these walls in the capital, Guatemala City, is the orphanage. The complex covers an entire city block. It was somewhere inside here, 64 years ago, that a then 10-year-old Marta Orellana says her nightmare began.
Y me acostaron en una camilla. Entonces un doctor estaba de este lado y el otro, y la enfermera me tenía agarrada la cabeza.
She says the director, Dr. Cofinho, hit her in the face to get her cooperation.
Entonces ellos empezaron, no sé si eran gasas o algodones, no sé, pero ellos me abrieron las piernas y me hicieron ese examen en mis partes, pues.
After this, she became so sick, she says she was bedridden for weeks. The next time she was called in, it was in a group of 10 girls.
Me volvieron a llamar y entonces ahí fue donde me pusieron con la cabeza hasta los pies, me doblaron y me sacaron el líquido de la columna.
Well, to intentionally infect children with a disease so that you can test drugs on them, it really sinks to about the lowest of the lows in the 7 levels of hell.
It's still unclear whether the experiments ended when Dr. Cutler left in 1948. Questions remain about this former mental asylum and whether testing continued here. One man, who is also listed as a plaintiff, is convinced that years after Dr. Cutler left, his brother was experimented on here. One day, he escaped and made it home, complaining doctors were constantly injecting him. Even though he didn't smoke, his pockets were full of cigarettes.
Sí, para que ellos se dejaran hacer cualquier cosa que quisieran los médicos ahí.
It's recorded in Cutler's notes that participants were given cigarettes for their participation. Another suspicious footnote is that years after the experiments are supposed to have ended, Marta Orellana says she was followed by one of the doctors involved in the experiments she endured as a 10-year-old child. She feared he wanted to continue his experiments on her.
Y andaba él hasta una vez que andábamos en la Aurora, en el zoológico.
After what she's learned studying two of the world's worst known examples of medical malpractice, Susan Reverby says anything is possible.
I mean, I think not exactly the same. I mean, most studies still have to go through institutional review boards, but clearly some kind of study that we will be equally shocked about is obviously going on right this minute somewhere else in the developing world, for sure.
Very sobering thoughts to reflect on there for anybody who thinks, well, that was done in the past and a lot of bad things were done in the past and they won't happen anymore because we've tidied things up since then. If anybody really thinks that, take one look, for example, at Fukushima. How tidy is the modern world in terms of people inflicting damage on other people? I wonder, did you think about GM there? If you control the Supreme Court, it's not a difficult matter to get them to write a piece of paper to say GM crops are substantially equivalent. So whatever happens, there'll be no legal comeback. Totally different matter to carry out large investigation and try and evaluate the impact of introducing novel organisms into the food chain or into the environment, looking generations down, what's going to happen. So in the real world, two totally different activities from the perspective of a corporate lawyer looking remarkably similar. That represents a kind of blind spot of the culture of control, which takes it as an assumption that the real world can be controlled. Now we continue with the radio show. This is still April 2012. Robert Knight is interviewing Piper Hendricks, lead attorney bringing the lawsuit for the Guatemalan people. And at that stage, the legal battle had not been resolved, although the writing did appear to be on the wall that the US government, if it doesn't feel like it, doesn't have to bother with facing the lawsuit. It just says sovereign immunity.
There is litigation underway seeking redress despite apologies that bring no comfort or succor other than rhetoric. We'll be speaking with the lead attorney, the plaintiffs being the Guatemalan people who are affected by many uninformed experiments, people who were drawn from penitentiaries, orphanages, and soldiers and other institutions in Guatemala. They were injected with syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases and not told about what that meant to them, their lives, and their health. The U.S. Public Health Service performed experimentation that included injecting syphilis. They scraped samples of infected puss and put it on the genitalia and the eyes of their so-called patients or their victims. Gonorrhea was also transmitted through similar tactics and techniques. This is reminiscent, of course, of the Public Health Service of the United States experiments in Tuskegee on black men, in which they claim that there were prior existing conditions of sexually transmitted diseases, in particular syphilis. The study, called Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male, from 1932 to 1972, has been acknowledged so far by the United States government. And the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues confirmed that the medical team knew exactly what they were doing and how it violated in so many ways the Hippocratic Oath and other international treaties and principles of ethical experimentation and medical treatment. The Obama administration did technically apologize for what was done in Guatemala, but perhaps that is not sufficient. And in just a few moments, we'll be speaking with lead attorney Piper Hendricks on the Guatemalan case. But this is how the Obama White House spun the apology.
You saw the statement by Secretary Clinton and Secretary Sebelius a while ago regarding unethical medical research done in Guatemala between 1946 and 1948. Yesterday afternoon, Secretary Clinton called President Colom of Colombia to express both her shock at the discovery of the details of this research and also to apologize on behalf of the American people. During the course of the conversation, she also invited Guatemala to participate fully in the investigation that we will carry out, determine the facts behind this research. There are some things that we have to find out, the disposition of those who were involved, the patients who were involved in this research between 1946 and 1948. We quite honestly do not know how many are still alive. But, we will determine the facts as best we can, and then those will inform, whatever follow-ups.
State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we are now joined live by one of the lead attorneys on the litigation for the Guatemalan people affected by the syphilis and other experiments in the person of Piper Hendricks, who joins us live from Washington, D.C. Well, Piper, welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Great to be here.
Well, it's some piece of work that you have to do before you. First of all, you heard the apology. It is said that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama issued apologies, but is it too little too late, or is it sufficient, or does it protect against future transgression?
Well, I think without any doubt it's not sufficient. I mean, an apology isn't something that goes back and undoes what happened to people, which obviously at this point can't be done. But an apology does not recover your medical expenses. It does not start to undo, the burden that these people have been bearing for many, many years. And one thing that I'd like to correct, at the time of the apology, people were under the impression that the experiment started in 46 and went through 48. Actually, later research by the commission has confirmed that the experiments lasted at least until 1953. It's not clear, it's possible that maybe they went on longer than that.
1953 is significant. Because I think a year later there was a United States-backed coup
in Guatemala. Yes, circumstances changed in Guatemala, but at the time that they started, it seemed like a perfect place to outsource experiments that the researchers knew at the time, and this is documented in their contemporaneous letters to each other. They knew that this is something that they could not get away with in the United States, so took the experiments to Guatemala to exploit the populations there instead.
Piper Hendricks is an attorney with Conrad and Scherer, and you have taken on the cause of the Guatemalan victims. Can you bring us into the magnitude, how you learned about it, the recent studies that broke previously covered up material? How did you get to the case, and what are you trying to do?
Well, our office handles a number of human rights cases down in South America and Central America and around the world, Ordinarily, we focus on corporate accountability issues, but because of our presence in those countries, people thought of us when it came to human rights cases and asked if we would take this on, which we did. I mean, this is something that is unquestionably deserving of a remedy. We actually tried, and this might surprise some people, as plaintiff's attorneys, we tried to discuss a settlement with the government before we filed the case, thinking that there might be some precedent set by Tuskegee. There might be a willingness to talk with us, you know, before the lawsuit was underway. Unfortunately, we did not receive any response, and so filed the lawsuit over a year ago now, and then waited for the Presidential Bioethics Commission to come out with its report, which it did last September. And that report, if anyone has, your listeners have read it, will know it's absolutely devastating. You know, over 200 pages outlining the experiments, what people were subjected to, the fact that they were intentionally infected, had no idea what was going on, you know, that they were being given venereal diseases. There's a lack of consent that's documented, and the fact that people were not then treated. Some were, but it was sort of haphazard. So many people were left with diseases that they then passed on to their spouses, potentially on to their children, and really having devastating effects in many Guatemalan communities. So what we're asking for now is a remedy for the individual victims. And we've been encouraged by a number of organizations who are stepping forward and joining us in this call, a number of human rights groups, international labor unions, religious groups, and even several bioethicists who have made comments in the media saying that this apology is not sufficient. When you have used people in medical experiments, whether or not you have their permission, if they're harmed, they are deserving of an individual remedy. And that's something that we have not seen any steps from the U.S. government, aside from an apology, to these individual victims. And that's, you know, to loop back to your original question, I mean, the response we've gotten so far is absolutely insufficient.
Piper Hendricks, I understand that there is even controversy in the universe of those who would be eligible, aside from those who have already died in the course of these experiments. The last time I looked, the Guatemalan government had identified more than 2,000 presumed victims of this American venereal experimentation, and yet the Obama government is saying that they only recognize a fewer number, 1,000 and some. Is that correct?
Well, there are a lot of numbers flying around. There were at least 5,000 that the Bioethics Commission has identified as participating in the experiments. And to be clear, not everyone was intentionally infected with venereal diseases. That number they're placing around 1,000. And so, you know, 1,000 are just, you know, beyond egregious. 5,000 are still, it's a very serious number in that they were involved in experiments without their consent. And that's something that's really important to keep in mind here. I mean, I think, you know, very basic human right for all of us is to have the control over our own body and what will be done to us and if we want to participate in a medical experiment or not. And that shouldn't be done to anyone without their permission. So that there's other questions of, you know, how many are surviving, how many it was passed along to. And it won't be, you know, it's not easy to come up with a specific number of survivors right now, but it is something that's doable and worth doing.
This is part of a wider syndrome, I suspect, Piper, in that we have in the past addressed the issue of how the Indian Health Service over a great many years sterilized damn near half the female population on many Indian territories and in Puerto Rico. And here also there is the issue of non-informed consent of medical procedures being done. And in Tuskegee, the government claims that the black men who were tested under a program set up by the same physician as set up the operation in Guatemala, they claim that the black men were not injected with syphilis or given syphilis, although I do not know whether that is actually true. But in any case, the egregious thing, it seems to me, is how brazenly people were given syphilis and gonorrhea and perhaps other diseases. Can you help us see, can you describe some of the specific techniques and violations that occurred?
I can, and just as a warning, some of them are really gruesome. The techniques that were used in Guatemala include lumbar punctures, removing spinal fluid from the back of the neck, mixing that with syphilitic material, and reinjecting it into the patient. In some cases, there was pus that was removed from one person and put into another's wounds, you know, scraping in the genitalia and then introducing things there. There's one instance even that's been documented of mixing syphilitic material into water and making people drink it to taste how, or to test how it would be transmitted through oral sex, for example. And it sounds absolutely bizarre, taking it out of context. I think remembering that at the time, we're talking about people coming back from, many of our soldiers coming back from World War II and having syphilis and other venereal diseases. And so the purpose of these experiments at the time was to try to find a proper treatment for soldiers who were coming back from the war with venereal diseases. And not that that would do anything to justify what took place in Guatemala, but that's what the experimenters had in mind when they were doing the horrible things that they were doing. And something very important that you touched on earlier is how this is not something, you know, while these particular experiments began many decades ago, there are many recent instances of not having consent in medical experiments that we need to keep in mind and remembering that we haven't, as a society, we haven't gotten it right just yet. There are experiments still going on in Africa where it's not clear that there's truly informed consent. You know, North Carolina recently settled some of its eugenics cases, and the fact that we're targeting in very vulnerable populations such as the African-American men in Tuskegee or Native Americans in our own country. I mean, it is really ugly what we're doing, and I think that we as a society need to pay attention and reinforce what the world had said at Nuremberg after World War II, that this is not something that we tolerate, and ensure that we truly implement every step of the way, making sure that we respect people's right to be free of non-consensual medical experimentation.
Are you aware of the work of Susan Reverby? She is a historian who helped bring forward some of this information. How significant is what she did? What did she uncover, and how did that help the ball to get rolling?
It's extremely significant. When she was doing her research, my understanding is that she looked at documents thinking that they were from the Tuskegee experiments in Alabama, and realized as she was going through the documentation that this, she was uncovering what happened in Guatemala. And since that's something that the world had not previously known, that was extremely significant to bring it up and say, we owe an apology and we owe a remedy to the people who were involved. And bringing things like that to light is very important, even decades later. I think it's tempting for some people to say it happened so long ago, it doesn't matter, but that's not true. I mean, this is something that we really need to face as a nation, recognizing that at the same time that we were championing human rights causes abroad, we were also doing some very ugly things abroad. And that's something that, you know, experts in intergenerational justice will tell you is not something, you know, when there are still people who are alive who were impacted by that, even if those who are alive today, the administration, the people who are in positions of power, no, they weren't personally involved, and yet we as a country owe a remedy to those people who were impacted by prior policies.
One of the names that would have come up in this research and your litigation is that of one John Cutler, who had the honorific MD on his mm-hmm. name. And he seems to me to be quite a bizarre creature in American and global medical history, in that he is implicated both in Tuskegee and Guatemala. What do we know about this man?
We know that he was involved in many experiments, that the two that you mentioned, you know, our focus here on Guatemala, also Tuskegee. He'd also done some experiments in Terre Haute, Indiana, in a penitentiary, and then went on to do other experiments after he left Guatemala in India. And I can't speak to, you know, I'm no expert on his life. I do think that he, though, is a good reminder of how we might be too zealous in wanting to find a particular cure or looking at a particular disease and not remembering that at every step along the way, you have to respect the human rights of the people who are involved.
Speaking of human rights, what laws are violated in procedures of this type, and on what grounds are you challenging the government in seeking redress for the Guatemalan victims?
We're challenging under both the Alien Tort Statute and under the Constitution. And the Alien Tort Statute is something that some of your listeners may have heard about recently. It's currently at issue in a case before the Supreme Court in a case called Kiobel. That one is focused on corporate accountability. But the issue here is just if you have a violation of international law, something that rises to something that's so egregious that the entire world essentially agrees that this is something that should not happen, such as torture, such as, you know, the non-consensual medical experimentation at issue here, then you can bring a case in U.S. court. And so we've brought that both for cruel and human degrading treatment that the Guatemalan victims endured and the medical experimentation. And then we've also brought two claims under the U.S. Constitution.
And yet, as recently as this year, earlier a couple of months ago, the Department of Justice is claiming that your litigation has no merit and is seeking a dismissal, much less contemplating any kind of reparations. What is the latest on that maneuver?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's very disappointing. They asserted immunity in January, and just this Monday, just yesterday, filed their reply supporting the motion to dismiss on the basis of immunity, saying that basically you can't reach the U.S. government unless the government gives you permission to, and that there's a number, I won't bore your listeners with the various laws, the Federal Tort Claims Act and that sort of thing, but you've only got enough exceptions to reach the government where it gives you permission, and there are exceptions to the exceptions that make it difficult to reach them when the conduct took place abroad. And so we're arguing, of course, that immunity does not apply. So now the briefs are what's called ripe and ready for the judge to decide. We'll be going back to court in June and going before the judge at that time.
I'm confused, Piper Hendricks. I'm confused because I hear very apologetic statements with trembling lips from President Obama and Secretary Clinton and all the way back to Vice President Gore and President Bill Clinton in the case of Tuskegee. So if the executive branch is acknowledging some error in foreign policy or in the operation of U.S. government agencies, why is the Justice Department taking a different stand? Does that put the lie to these apologies?
It does, yeah. In no uncertain terms, it does. I think something that we have to keep in mind is that the DOJ attorneys who are involved are, like any attorney would, defending their client with every recourse that's available. If you have a defense that might be viable, you as an attorney should assert it. And in this case, their client happens to be the U.S. government. And it's not until they get a message from people higher up saying, wait a minute, this isn't a typical case, this is not the time that we want to be asserting immunity, they'll keep moving forward as they would, like any attorney would in any other case. But, you know, given the circumstances of this case, it's not just any other case. And the way that this makes us look on the international stage, I mean, we appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners about this. It hasn't gotten much domestic coverage, whereas the international press is really having quite a field day. I mean, we look really bad, and people are talking about what they call the experiments of the devil or experimentos del diablo. I mean, it's not pretty, and so it's something where I think that somebody up, you know, further up the chain of command needs to remember what President Obama said late 2010, what Secretary Clinton, what Secretary Sebelius all apologized for, and, you know, bring that to this particular case and say this isn't the reaction that we as a country want to have. And that's something that we, you know, your listeners can help with on this, and that we need that message to get to people who can make these decisions, to President Obama, to representatives in the U.S. Congress, saying we need to make this a priority. And that's difficult. We're in an election year. There's a lot of different issues everyone knows going on right now. But looking at this both at the particular victims who are involved and in the broader course of events, of the, you know, our reputation on the world stage and who we are as an American public, I think this is something that should take priority. People who were impacted in the late 40s are not getting younger. You know, we've literally already lost one plaintiff who learned of the horrible things that were done to him and now has passed away without seeing justice, which is really a tragedy.
I'm sure you're familiar with a letter signed by some of the brightest lights of medicine, ethics, human rights, of Americans, and in fact, an international distinguished panel wrote a letter in February to Secretary Clinton and President Obama. And if you'll bear with me for the audience, I would just like to read a short passage of that letter. which says, while we recognize and applaud that both of you apologized to Guatemala in October 2010 for these human rights atrocities and recognized that the experiments were egregiously unethical as well as non-consensual, we were disappointed that the U.S. offered no more than an apology to the Guatemalan victims, their heirs, and communities impacted by these devastating abuses. It continues, saying, now we are appalled to learn that the Department of Justice has asserted immunity in Garcia et al. Versus Sebelius et al., the legal case that the Guatemalan victims have brought in a U.S. court in order to obtain a tangible remedy for their human rights claims. In effect, it is as if the United States has announced to the world that merely saying that it is sorry is sufficient compensation to the aggrieved families for the substantial wrongs done in the name of our government. I'd like your reaction to that. And I'm seeing a bigger picture here also, Piper, when you contemplate your answer. And that is, the United States is engaged in multiple military, medical, hearts and minds, social operations throughout the Mideast, Africa, and elsewhere around the world. So it may be that what happens in Guatemala does not stay in Guatemala. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I don't know that I can say it much better than all the groups did in the letter. I mean, that really is, when you take a step back and have someone say, I'm sorry, you know, very, very sorry, and then do nothing further, that speaks volumes. I mean, it's the, you know, actions speaking louder than our words. And right now, I think something we need to keep in mind is the concept of, you know, justice and reciprocity. I mean, if this is how we're treating citizens of other countries, how do we expect to be treated when we go abroad? I mean, there are, again, that I'm proud as an American to think back on our history of, you know, leading the way with the League of Nations, thinking of Eleanor Roosevelt and her role in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and really coming together after World War II as an entire society and saying these are the standards to which we want to hold ourselves. And yet here we are decades later kind of throwing those away. And I don't know what happened to those as a society, but I would like to see us return to those standards that we set forth and really uphold those. I mean, that there's respect for humanity that goes beyond our borders. And if you know that people have suffered because of the actions of your own country, you have a responsibility to address that.
Well, here is the insult that some would say is being added to injury. The Obama administration allocated $1 million to study ethics in regard to situations like this, new rules to protect volunteers and human subject experiments, and gave less than $1 million to Guatemala. $750,000 was granted to Guatemala, quote, to fight sexually transmitted diseases, end quote. Mm-hmm. And this reminds me of the horror of the original Guatemalan experiments in which the United States government withheld aid and material and supplies that had been in the pipeline in order to make Guatemala put prostitutes and soldiers and orphans and poor people in harm's way with these vile experiments. Is money a substitute for justice?
Well, I think that there's two questions in there. I mean, at this point, you can't undo what happened. And so there's not enough money in the world that will undo that. But at the same time, there is something that can be done. I mean, if we use Tuskegee as an example, the survivors and their families were later offered burial benefits, medical benefits, and so you can try to make things better. But I think the fact that we're throwing money at, again, much like after Tuskegee, reviewing our standards and making sure that the law is in place. I mean, there's part of me that wonders, will we ever get this right? How many tragedies do we have before we get our laws strong enough to protect people? But I think that throwing money at it, there's a quote I'd like to read you from the brief that came in yesterday that says that they're looking, that they've pledged, you know, almost $1 million to improve Guatemala's surveillance of STDs, capacity to diagnose STDs, and guidelines for diagnosing and treating STDs. And then the $1 million goes to support the evaluation of the sufficiency of the current HHS regulations and revisions currently under consideration. And as I read that, I just thought, we're thinking about maybe trying to kind of consider, and I thought, my goodness, that is just not, it's not sufficient. You need to look at the individual people who were involved. And absolutely, I mean, in diseases like this impact an entire community. And so addressing that entire community is appropriate, but it is just one step. And until we get to the individuals who were involved and say, we are sorry, and here is how we are going to concretely help you, we have not fulfilled our responsibility.
You have gotten support from quarters here in New York City, where the city council has contemplated a resolution that says, in part, whereas in a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of the thousands of Guatemalan victims of non-consensual human medical experimentation by the U.S. authorities, the Department of Justice claimed immunity for the United States and sought to dismiss the lawsuit. That would be your work, Piper. And the resolution resolves that the New York City Council condemns the Attorney General's assertion of immunity and urges the United States government to provide a remedy to the individual Guatemalan victims for the abuses of their human rights. How is New York standing up for this, and what kind of response and support are you getting elsewhere across the nation or around the world?
Well, I've got to say, I've always loved New Yorkers, and now I love you guys even more. I mean, the support there has really been fantastic, both, as you mentioned, from the city council and then also groups. There's the Taxi Cab Drivers Union helped us out on the letter that you mentioned earlier.
That would be our fine colleague, John McDonough of Radio Free Erin.
Yes, indeed. And it's been really fantastic to see. There's a change.org petition that's going, and I see a lot of signatures from New York, and it's just really encouraging to see people, you know, take a moment and demonstrate that they care. And if there's any listeners who now would like to add their name to that, the change.org petition is called Fair Compensation for Guatemalan Victims of U.S. Medical Experimentation. So if you go to change.org and search for Guatemalan, you'll pull up that petition, and adding your name to that and calling for the administration to do something concrete for these victims is a great way to help. We're also asking people to contact people on the Hill. I mean, starting at the state legislature is a great start. But the ultimate goal here is for someone at the U.S. administration level to take notice of this case and say, people care, and we want to have a fair remedy for people. So, you know, if listeners have 2 minutes to make a call to the Capitol Hill switchboard, we welcome that assistance as well. That number is 202-224-3121, and they can call, ask to talk to Senator Kerry, ask to talk to Representative Berman, you know, people on the Foreign Affairs Committee, looking at the Western Hemisphere, you know, people, your own representatives calling and saying, this is something I want you to pay attention to. And we've gotten feedback in no uncertain terms that if people start hearing from their constituents, they will take interest and hopefully take action on this case.
Aside from your spearheading the litigation, I'm curious about two things that, as far as I know, have not happened. One of them is legislation explicitly forbidding these crimes against humanity or crimes against ethics or, you know, the injection of diseases without knowledge or consent. I'm concerned that I'm not aware of any legislation to prevent the recurrence of this kind of thing. Certainly in the battlefields and wars and depleted uranium and chemical and high technology weapon systems that are being used, somebody must be studying this kind of thing today, even as we speak. So I'm wondering, what is the state of legislation to prevent this? And second, have there been, and if not, why not, have there not been any criminal prosecutions in regard to these escapades?
Well, I'll take your second question first, because it's a bit more simple. The criminal prosecutions would have to be brought against individuals, and many of the individuals who were involved, it seems most who were named within the Bioethics Commission's report, are deceased now. And so you can't bring criminal charges against someone who's no longer alive, unlike a civil case, which you could bring against an estate, for example, or subsequent people in those positions. There were some changes in legislation following Tuskegee, but as you're noting, I mean, there's still some holes there. There's still, you know, we still have room for improvement, and that's something that after going back and looking at all the documentation that was left from the experiments, the Presidential Bioethics Commission then took the next step of looking at what holes there are and how we can ensure that this doesn't happen again. And that's a report that they issued end of last year. And where that's gone, I must confess I've been focused on the litigation and have not followed that as closely. So I think that that's something that, that is out there. How it's progressing right now, I'm not sure.
You are doing yeoman's duty in trying to bring such a huge and egregious situation to justice. And Piper Hendricks, with the law firm Conrad and Scherer in Washington, D.C., I open the floor to you for your own reflection. Has this touched you in any way that's different from other litigation you've been in? And tell us how we might be as motivated as you to seek international and bodily justice.
It's definitely been very touching. I actually went down to Guatemala in March and had a chance to meet with someone who was impacted by the experiments. And hearing his story, and as he sat there thinking about how his life might have been different, for example, he was very cold toward his wife and not wanting to have children for fear that he might pass along that disease. And there's a lot of shame, even today, with many venereal diseases, and you know, very much so in the 1940s, 1950s as well. And so as he sat there thinking how his life would have changed had he not had something shameful that he couldn't share with his own wife, had he not had to deal with the repercussions of the experiments, he broke down. And I thought, this is someone who has been living with the impact of what was done to him without his permission for longer than I've been alive. And that was really, really moving. And I think that that's something that, you know, in our day-to-day lives, it's very easy to get caught up in, you know, especially in this economy. Am I going to be able to pay my mortgage? Am I going to be able to put food on the table? Am I, you know, there's many different concerns that we all have, some very small, some very large. But I think keeping a big picture perspective of how we treat each other being so incredibly important is something that is really at the core of all of our cases. And so while it has been a long journey, this news came out in end of 2010, and here we are already into spring of 2012, recognizing who we are as a people and still, you know, having pride in being an American and seeing what our potential is, even if we're not yet realizing it, I think is something that keeps me going. And if there are people who would like to join us, as I mentioned, signing your name on the Change.org petition, sharing that with just one, two, three friends to add their name. I mean, it's been exciting to see how Change.org has had an impact. You know, calling your congressman, calling your representative, and making your voice heard. I mean, it's a crazy time that we're living in with so many different issues, but there's really nothing that replaces calling up and saying, I care about this issue. And enough people do that, there will be steps taken. And that I believe that, and I hope that your listeners can take a few moments out of their days, which I know are already very busy, but take that time to help add their voice to this cause.
Well, you certainly have our respect, Piper Hendricks, and I presume also the support of our audience of goodwill. And I thank you for bringing forward a story that is too little recognized and one that will come back to haunt us in future circumstances, I do fear, under the current way the government operates. But I would leave you with some words that I find useful every now and then, that the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice.
Martin Luther King, yes, that's one of the things I love about D.C. We've got his memorial now, and that's one that I go by and see on morning runs, and that keeps me going. So thank you. Those are great words.
Now, that was 3 years ago, so you don't need to bother ringing any congressman, not that I think you were about to anyway. I include it because it illustrates for me the hopelessness, the vacuousness of the culture of control. If we accept, okay, let's defer to a group of nine men, then what can we really expect? Could we make it any easier for those of unscrupulous character to control our decision-making process? Well, we could have one man instead of nine men, but more or less, it's an abdication of our moral capabilities. Now, this first half of the show has been a preparation for the following interview, which is the first time on the show we featured the controversial topic of vaccines. We're interviewing Dr. Tony Bark, a homeopathic practitioner who raises a lot of concerns with vaccines and with the modern medical institutions. Whilst I'm relatively uninformed on the medical issues, I'm not a doctor, I found her thoughts on the statistics and the regulatory structure quite compelling. The CDC, the ability of Big Pharma to control by capturing these regulatory organizations, that is really what inspired me to include this interview on the show. It's from episode 27 of The Infectious Myth. That's from 2014, and the interviewer is David Crow.
Today I will discuss the recent CDC vaccination scandal with pediatrician and so much more, Tony Bark. What was revealed, how to interpret it, what it says about the MMR vaccine and autism, and whether there are any more general conclusions that we can draw from this. You can contact me by email at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join our Facebook community at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Dr. Bark received a bachelor's in psychology in 1981 and a medical degree from Rush Medical School in 1986, completing her residency at the University of Illinois, Chicago in 1991. She ran the pediatric emergency room at Michael Reese Hospital until 1993, when she went back to school to study holistic, or sometimes called integrative, medicine. Since training in homeopathy, she has had a private practice for more than 15 years. You can go to Dr. Bark's website, disease-reversal.com, for more information. But one of the things I noticed there was that she spends a long time with her patients trying to understand more than any immediate symptoms they may have. She wants to understand the patient's body, their environment, and also their beliefs and emotional state. But today, we're going to focus on her understanding of the vaccine issue. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bark.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me. Appreciate
it. Is it okay that I call you Tony during the...
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Please do call me Tony.
Yes. Okay. So let's get right to the starting point, which is that there has been a whistleblower at the CDC for some time, and I guess some people have known about this, but recently it was kind of forced into the open, and I don't think we need to get into exactly how that happened, but I think the important thing for us is what information came out and what the whistleblower said to confirm this information. So can you kind of describe the situation?
Yeah, best to my knowledge, I'm going to back up a little bit because I had seen Dr. Brian Hooker present, who's not the whistleblower. Brian Hooker is a biochemist, PhD, whose son was vaccine damaged with autism. Mm-hmm. And he had, under FOIA, requested documents from the CDC from the Simpson Wood conference. He had not, so I saw him present the evidence and kind of the data about a year and a half ago at an Autism One conference, and also heard Kennedy Jr. present as well on what he had gotten under FOIA. And really what I had undertaken home from that meeting, from listening to them speak, was that the Simpson Wood conference, which was a CDC conference, which was held not on the grounds of the CDC, but somewhere else, and they weren't making the notes public, which, by the way, usually when the FDA or the CDC meet and have public hearings, these things are all public, supposed to be, because they're paid for by tax dollars. So that's one thing that you have to understand, that any data that a federal agency collects from tax dollars, which is, if they're a federal agency, that's what's paying them, should theoretically be public, in the public domain.
Right.
But what was presented at the time was that, there were notes saying we can't make this go away, meaning the link between the MMR and autism.
Right.
And that there was evidence showing the exposure to thimerosal, also on their specific study of the thimerosal, the greater the risk of autism. And the early exposure, meaning, a one-week-old versus, a 3-year-old. And
okay.
What the upshot of that conference was,